From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. The numbers are in. Hillary Clinton takes Ohio and Rhode Island, and she lassos a crucial victory in the Texas primary.
For everyone who has stumbled but stood right back up, and for everyone who works hard and never gives up, this one is for you.
Barack Obama took Vermont. He's also set to win the Texas caucuses, and he still holds a slim lead in delegates.
Because of a movement you built that stretches from Vermont's Green Mountains to the streets of San Antonio, we can stand up with confidence to say we are ready to write the next great chapter in America's story.
As for the Republicans, John McCain has all been guaranteed the GOP nomination after sweeping all of yesterday's primaries.
Now we begin to make a respectful and convincing case to the American people that our campaign, given the alternatives presented by our friends in the other party, are in the best interests of the country we love.
Joining me now to talk about the election results is Michelle Bernard. She heads the Independent Women's Forum, a conservative think tank based in Washington, D.C. Also, Michael Fauntroy, assistant professor of public policy at George Mason University. Hi, folks.
Hi there.
Hello.
So let's break down the numbers first, and then we will talk about this delegate situation. For the Democratic candidates, the key states were Ohio and Texas. Hillary won both the primaries, but it looks like Obama's going to win the caucus in Texas, this thing called the Texas two-step. Michael, in Texas, Latino voters were expected to play key roles. Was that a voting block that made a difference for Senator Clinton?
I think it is. The conventional wisdom, some of which I tend to agree with, suggested that there was going to be a generational breakdown among Latino voters in Texas. And while there may have been a generational breakdown, the reality is Senator Clinton got about two-thirds of a Latino vote, and that is a substantial number given that Latino voters make up about 25% of the state's voting population, generally speaking. So I think it was a very, very good night for her with regard to Latino voters.
Michelle, what about Ohio? There were different demographic things at play. Hillary also took Ohio. What was going on there?
You know, Ohio is a very, very interesting state. Early on, looking at polls that were being taken prior to the Ohio primary and even the exit polls last night, I always suspected that Senator Clinton, if there was one primary she was going to win on March 4th, that it would have been Ohio. Her appeal amongst white women in Ohio was enormous. Her appeal amongst white men was very solid. I'm hearing these folks being referred to as white ethnics. I'm not really quite sure what that means, but the appeal was strong. It was solid. I think her advertisements that played on fear and national security concerns, as well as all of the recent talk about NAFTA and whether or not trade agreements like NAFTA take away jobs, played upon people's fears in Ohio, and her voters came out very strong for her. I also would say that, you know, some of the early opinion polls, people were very open and honest. There was no Bradley effect in Ohio, and I don't want to say that all white males think this way, because they certainly don't, but there were a lot of white males in early opinion polls that really came out and said that they could not vote for a black person under any circumstances whatsoever. Some of them were going to hold their nose and vote for Senator Clinton, and I suspect that a lot of people stayed home and have decided that they're going to vote for John McCain in November rather than vote for anyone in the Democratic Party at all. And I suspect that we saw a lot of that happening in Ohio last night. It was very clear from early on that we were not going to see in Ohio what we have seen in states like Iowa and Wisconsin going in Senator Obama's favor.
Michael, do you think that this was a case where race once again reared its head? I mean, I was talking to a couple folks who said Ohio has, you know, there have been racial issues in some of Ohio's cities. Then again, where have there not been racial issues? And so the question becomes, was this a state where race played a high factor?
Well, I tend to believe you can never really underestimate the role that race may play in elections. But if you look closely at what happened in Ohio, you know, Senator Obama won where he was expected to win, in Cleveland, Columbus, Cincinnati, places like that. And Hillary Clinton carried, you know, the majority of the rest of the state. And even with the record turnout, I think you can make the argument that it was less about race and more about the economic insecurity questions that people have in Ohio, with the high unemployment rates and concern about job loss and a teetering national economy. I think that the refrain from the 1992 campaign, that is, it's the economy, stupid, may actually be reborn in 2008.
You know, Farai, also I would add, it's kind of interesting if you look at Ohio and Texas to sort of play upon what Michael just said. Senator Obama won in all of the big cities. And in Texas, you know, for example, he won in Houston, he won in Dallas, he won in Austin. Senator Clinton took over the rest of the state. And, you know, to just paraphrase a friend of mine, Chris Matthews, over at NBC, one of the things that we were noticing as we were watching the returns come in is that you could almost argue that we're beginning to almost see a sort of class warfare. People who have who are educated, who have college degrees, that earn, you know, $50,000 or more per year, tend to vote for Barack Obama. We saw that strong last night in Texas and in Ohio. More blue collar workers that are really feeling economically insecure at this point in time seem to be remembering the good old days of Bill Clinton, as a lot of people told us in exit polls. And some of these people felt that if they vote for Senator Clinton, that she will be getting the sage advice of her husband, and that jobs will, you know, manufacturing jobs will somehow just miraculously start to pour back in to Ohio. It is very interesting to see how this is playing out.
Michael, what about this whole delegate situation? In a second, I want to move on to the Republicans, who have a very different situation, a very different way of counting the numbers. But there right now does not seem to be a way to avoid some kind of hand from Democratic Party leaders, whether it's superdelegates or whether it's the head of the DNC. What's going to happen, considering that no matter who wins, they're not going to reach this magic number?
You know, Farai, there's so much that can be said about this delegate counting process. You know, if the Democrats counted the delegates the way the Republicans do, this nomination would have ended some time ago, and we wouldn't even be talking about Barack Obama, because Hillary Clinton has cleaned up in the largest states that have had the contest. But we have this proportional system, and in some places it's even more convoluted when you consider in Texas you have the primaries and then the caucuses and proportional distribution thereafter. I think it's going to go to the superdelegates. While I'm not crazy about the idea that there should be superdelegates, I think that if they are going to be there, and they are, they ought to be able to vote their conscience, whatever their conscience, however they define that. So for that reason, I'm not necessarily too upset about it. The reality is many of these superdelegates have put in years and years in the party and campaigns and former elected officials and so on and so forth. And it seems to me that they have, you know, almost as much of a reason to claim some knowledge of their local electorates as anybody else. And having said all that, though, it is going to go to the superdelegates. And I have to tell you, Farai, if the Obama supporters' argument that the superdelegates should vote the way the states are going is the way that this begins to break out, then Hillary Clinton has a chance to gain because she's won so many of the largest states.
Want to move you to McCain, to the Republicans. The president has endorsed Senator John McCain. Does this effectively mean that the Republicans are in the pole position because they have their minds made up while the Democrats are still figuring out what to do?
This is great positioning for the Republican Party and for Senator McCain. Number one, what President Bush's endorsement of Senator McCain does for him is it sort of lends him a little bit of support and credibility from the conservative part of the party that likes President Bush but is not so enchanted with Senator McCain. Also, it gives him a huge jump on Senator Clinton and Senator Obama in terms of fundraising, and he can immediately start his general campaign right now. From now and through November, he will start campaigning against Senator Obama. He will start campaigning against Senator Clinton. And they are giving him a blueprint, literally blow by blow, about how to campaign against them. And I think that the fact that Clinton and Obama will not only be campaigning against one another, but the fact that they're now going to be in the position where they have to campaign against him, it would allow him to stay in the media and garner attention. And people will not forget about him the way we forgot about Governor Huckabee and even Ron Paul.
Well, Governor Huckabee, does he still have any power in terms of wrangling conservatives in the party? It seems as if he's going to play nice with Senator McCain. What good can he do to McCain, or are conservatives still going to be upset?
I think conservatives, there is a segment of the conservative coalition that is still not yet ready to accept John McCain. And so he's going to have to spend his time working on that segment. And perhaps Huckabee can be helpful in that regard. Everything I've heard suggests that the two of them have a pretty good personal relationship and that Huckabee would be helpful. He probably wants to be vice president as well. So I would imagine that an opportunity to get on the ticket would be even more of an inducement to Huckabee to do all he can to get behind McCain.
I mean, conservatives and evangelical conservatives in particular are quite enamored with Governor Huckabee. Women who, disproportionately go out and vote, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, but, polls are showing that Republican women really like Governor Huckabee. He is from the South, and I think when you put all of that together, he could be a very attractive candidate for Senator McCain, because I strongly suspect that the very social conservative wing of the Republican Party is never going to fully embrace Senator McCain. His base and where his strong suit is with independents, it's with Reagan Democrats, it is with fiscal conservatives and moderate Republicans.
Well, Michelle, Michael, thank you so much.
No problem.
Thank you.
Michelle Bernard is president and CEO of the Independent Women's Forum, a conservative think tank based in Washington, D.C. And Michael Fauntroy is assistant professor of public policy at George Mason University. They both join me from our NPR studios in Washington. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton are still battling it out for the Democratic nomination, but Senator John McCain has the Republican nomination sewn up and is going in for a victory hug from President Bush. Plus, the Black Mayor's Convention is packing up and moving because of the Detroit mayor's legal problems. For more on all things political, we've got Dr. Mary Frances Berry. She's a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. She's also a former commissioner of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. And Ron Christie, vice president of the lobbying firm DC Navigators. He is also a former special assistant to President George W. Bush. Hi, folks.
Hello, Farai.
Hello, Farai.
So it's great to have you guys on, as always. I'm going to actually start with you, Ron. You've got the president officially endorsing John McCain. The flowers and the hugs are out. What does this do for Senator McCain and for the Republican Party?
I think what this does, first and foremost, Farai, is the beginning of the handoff of the torch from President Bush to now the new leader of the Republican Party, which is Senator McCain. You will find the White House, the Republican National Committee, and the congressional campaigns now taking their lead and their direction from Senator McCain from here forth through the November election. What are the policies? What are the politics? What is the best path forward that Senator McCain, now as the new presumptive leader of the Republican Party, will forge? So it's a very symbolic handing of the torch today, and I think that you'll see President Bush move to the side and let Senator McCain take more of the spotlight.
That's big, Mary. I mean, the whole idea that it's not just about the election, it's about the whole Republican leadership. Do you buy that? Do you think that the Republican leadership has essentially passed the torch to McCain?
Well, I think that's right, because Bush is so over. I mean, he's just over. And it's just a matter of time. And there's nobody else who can claim. Poor old Huckabee, I sort of liked him being in there. He's kind of funny. He's gone. And everybody else. So there is nobody else who has that stature. They don't have the Congress. There's nobody else. And Supreme Court justices don't speak in public politically. So there's McCain. And so he's the whole ball of wax now.
Now, there's all sorts of dynamics that the Republicans are going to have to face. When you take a look at things, Ron, you've got earlier this week McCain accepting the endorsement of the televangelist John Hagee. He's referred to the Roman Catholic Church as a false cult, and that got a lot of people hot under the collar. On the other hand, he seemed to tick off another supporter who was repeating the chant Barack Hussein Obama, and that guy now says that he's no longer going to support McCain. So it's kind of he's in a Scylla and Charybdis position. How's he going to navigate those waters of what conservatives want?
Well, I think what Senator McCain and the luxury that he has right now with the Democratic nomination not being sewn up, Senator McCain's going to be on page 2, page 3, page 4 of the newspapers, while the newspapers are going to focus instead on Senator Clinton and Senator Obama and the battle and the palace intrigue. What Senator McCain has to do now that the spotlight is not firmly upon him, now that he's the nominee, is to mend those bridges. You were making reference to Bill Cunningham, the conservative talk radio host in Cincinnati. Senator McCain needs to lay out the case to the conservative tax groups, to the conservative talk radio show hosts, and the Republican base. Those are who are concerned about his positions on taxes and immigration and campaign finance, and shore up their support now, such that when the Democrats finally settle on their nominee, Senator McCain will have his his troops behind him, and he'll go in with a financial as well as a support base from the conservatives.
Mary, is this a double standard in the sense that when Minister Louis Farrakhan showed support for Barack Obama, Obama publicly denounced or rejected Farrakhan's support? Is it a situation where McCain should be held to that standard for Hagee?
Well, I think everybody should be held to the same standard, but as one of those so-called black leaders who a few years ago we were all asked in public by media to whether we denounced Louis Farrakhan. I've been down this road before. And then we were all asked whether we rejected him, and we had to go back and forth and all do that dance in public because of his views. I think that everybody should be held to the same standard, and McCain should avoid being endorsed in this period. Now he's the nominee by people that won't help him, and they'll just raise questions. He's got to avoid that and only be endorsed by people who are going to help him. That's that's really tough to do when you're a candidate, and he ought to be made to apologize or do the denunciation trippy, the light fantastic like everybody else.
Now, Mary, you've talked a lot about internecine warfare among the Democrats. Are you afraid that it's just a wrap from here on out, that there's going to be, there's charges of skin darkening in commercials and false allegations? Are you afraid for the Democrats?
Well, not really. I mean, I've seen much nastier campaigns in my time. I think what's going to happen here, and it's good, that it's not all wrapped up. I mean, just think if it were. We would have from March all the way to August in the convention to do what? to have people define candidates in ways that don't make sense. And we have a lot of people who haven't voted yet. We have some fun of figuring out who's going to win, because Florida and Michigan, I predict, will be resolved by the DNC in some way, probably a do-over between now and the time, because the Democrats desperately need Florida to win the election, the general election, and they're not going to leave Florida hanging out there. And then there's this suspense about whether superdelegates are really going to do what they were designed to do, which is to figure out who can win the election and go to that person, or are they going to be afraid that they'll alienate one group of the party, the blacks, the women, the Latinos, and will they drive the Latinos to McCain? All those interesting questions that the superdelegates have to sort out, because they don't want to be responsible for picking somebody who loses. And so I think that there won't be really nasty things of the type I've seen in other campaigns. But I do think one thing, Barack Obama needs to come to terms with the fact that, yes, his middle name is Hussein. It's a perfectly honorable name. Just because Saddam Hussein was named that, I mean, hey, there are people in the Muslim world all around and here in the United States who are named that. So that doesn't get
embrace your inner Hussein.
Yeah.
Well, Mary, I have to move us on. We got a couple more things to touch on, and I'm going to ask you guys to keep it tight. On CBS's The Early Show, Clinton hinted that she could share the Democratic presidential ticket with Barack Obama. Just really quickly, Ron, do you buy that? And then Mary, do you buy that?
No, of course I don't. I don't think there's any conceivable way. Senator Clinton has looked at this as being a coronation for her, and Senator Obama has muddied the waters for her waltz to the nomination. I don't think she would go with Senator Obama on the ticket.
I think if Obama gets it, she wouldn't be Veep. If she gets it, he might be Veep.
Now, one last topic. There is a scandal going on.
Was that tight enough for you?
That was really tight. Ooh, where's my next question? What am I going to do now? but there's this scandal involving the Detroit mayor, Kwame Kilpatrick, and the National Conference of Black Mayors basically was like, hey, we're out of here. We're moving our annual convention. They let go of 1,100 hotel rooms. Detroit could use the money. Do you think this is a good decision for the Conference of Black Mayors, Mary, to say we just got to get out of here?
I think it's a wonderful decision because Kilpatrick should have resigned by now. And the longer he stays on, the more of a problem it is. And maybe other people who are supposed to go there won't go. And it's a great decision for New Orleans, which is where I think the Conference of Black Mayors has decided that they're going to meet. So I think that Kilpatrick is an albatross around the necks of the people in Detroit right now, whether they know it or not. And I think most of them do. And I think he should resign. And it's a good decision on the part of the mayors.
Ron, do you think that this sets a precedent for good governance? And what about Detroit?
Well, I feel sorry for the people of Detroit. I echo what the good professor said a second ago. Absolutely. This is a terrible, terrible situation that the mayor has put himself in due to his own personal lack of discretion, shall we say. And the people who live in Detroit are the ones who are made to suffer. Detroit has been on somewhat of an economic rebound. There have been companies that have moved there, companies that are interested in investing there. And his personal behavior, his bad behavior, has led folks to move out from this convention, has had people give a second glance at the city of Detroit, Michigan, which is a shame. He should go. He should resign. He's a disgrace.
Well, it's always great to talk to you guys. Thanks so much.
All right.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Take care, Farai.
Bye.
Ron Christie is the vice president of the lobbying firm DC Navigators. He's also a former special assistant to President George W. Bush. And Dr. Mary Frances Berry is a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania and a former commissioner of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. And they both joined us from our DC studios. News and Notes is taking over some new digital real estate, and you can join us. Our web producer, Jeffrey Bennett, is here to tell you how. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Farai.
So, this week, we're bringing out a new way for listeners to interact with us and each other. Tell us about it.
Well, News and Notes now has a presence on Facebook. And for those who are unfamiliar, Facebook is a popular social networking site which allows people to create detailed profiles and then network with each other based on geography, mutual interests, and mutual friends. And so there are about 67 million registered Facebook users. So the chances are pretty good that when you sign on, you'll meet some people you know and some people you lost touch with. So for people who already have an account, they should do a search for NPR News and Notes and link up with us. And for those who don't, signing on takes about 5 minutes. You can create a profile. And once again, that page is NPR News and Notes. And once there, folks can talk with us, debate current events, share photos and videos, and stream our daily podcast all in one spot.
I actually am a Johnny-come-lately to Facebook, and I found that a lot of people who I didn't know really wanted to, friend me because they like the show. And so this is a chance for us to have a forum where we can actually talk about the show. And it really, it's just a new age. What is social networking brought to the table, you think, just in general for people?
Well, you know, it really allows people to connect one-on-one in ways that haven't existed before. And so you can drill down based on where you live, what your interests are, who you share as friends, and connect in that way.
So on yesterday's show, we talked about a new study showing that a record number of Americans are behind bars. There's been a lot of discussion about that online. What are folks saying?
Yeah, that study also indicated that 1 in 9 black men between the ages of 20 and 34 are behind bars. So a reader named Ruby wrote, "The numbers tell me that it's time for a new approach in America. How about we invest in prevention?" S. Singleton wrote in our blog, "The prison system is big business in this extremely capitalistic country." And another reader named Jared wrote, "Most people in prison are not monsters who need to be caged, but people who have made bad decisions, often for lack of better ones."
And what are some of the other hot topics on the blog this week?
We're talking about the depiction of black fathers on TV, mainly via reality shows. We are dissecting the branding of the three top presidential candidates, looking at their logos and their marketing campaigns. And we also stirred up the old debate over black versus African American. An op-ed writer said he wanted to go back to being called black, so we talked about that. And based on an unscientific analysis of the response, most of our readers want to be called black.
Okay. Back in black. Jeff, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Bennett is the web producer for News and Notes, and he's here at our studios at NPR West. Now we're moving on to our bloggers' roundtable. The votes are in. Last night, Hillary Clinton ended her string of losses in the Democratic presidential primaries. We're going to hear more about that. Plus, is the race for good press on? Is the mainstream media anti-Hillary? We'll find out. With us today, we've got Arlene Fenton. She runs the blog Black Women Vote. Former Los Angeles Superior Court Judge Kevin Ross. He blogs at Three Brothers and a Sister. And self-described vigilante pundit Baratunde Thurston. He's a blogger for sites including the Huffington Post. He also writes for Jack and Jill Politics under the pseudonym Jack Turner. Welcome, folks.
Pleasure to be here. Yes.
So, pundit said Hillary Clinton needed to win big last night in order to stay in the race, and she did. But she is still behind in the delegate count. So where does the race go from here? Baratunde, you are in Dallas, Texas right now. What's the mood?
The mood that I was that I witnessed at campaign headquarters last night was everybody's ready to roll to Pennsylvania. There was a sort of acknowledgement of the math that still favors Senator Obama pretty strongly, and a little bit of frustration and anger about kind of the methods of the last few days that the Clinton campaign has continued to employ that felt very negative, again, very divisive. And you see that those last breaking votes did go for her. So when you look at the 3 a.m. ad or her failure to sort of resoundingly acknowledge, you know, his Christian faith and kind of leave ambiguous the fact that he may be a Muslim and not say that that's not a bad thing that you're a Muslim, sort of throws up in the air a little bit more of the ugly side of the campaign that we've been seeing. So there's frustration, definite frustration, but also happiness about the caucuses and the way those turned out. And on the black people side, I was going door to door a lot. I was just very impressed with how educated people seemed about the process and how invigorated they were to finally have some kind of say in way this was, where this was going to go.
Kevin, do you see the race taking a really negative turn at this point?
Oh, my God, it's already taken a negative turn. Just in the last few days alone, you have seen this fusillade, if you will, of negative, how can we undermine Barack? How can we take issues such as what's going on with, what is his name, Tony Resco in Chicago? Let's get him in a picture with his garb on, this garb that he was in when he was traveling in this Kenyan garb. And let's look at Michelle Obama's thesis from when she was at Princeton in 1985. And what about those kindergarten papers that he was saying, you know, he's always wanted to be president. He's an egomaniac. It is amazing to me to see the vitriol. And the thing that's so distressing to me is that it's working. Yeah. It's working. That's the thing about it, because folks clearly over the last few days responded to Hillary's throw in the kitchen sink, let's challenge this whole thing of black remorse. I mean, listen to me, black remorse, buyer's remorse, pardon the pun. But it seems to have had an effect.
Arlene, do you think that the negative campaigning is the way that Senator Clinton could clinch this?
I do. I mean, we all say that we hate negative campaigning, but the reality is it works. And I actually blogged about that today, because my question is, how is Barack Obama going to respond to that while still keeping his mantra of running a positive campaign? If he doesn't respond to the negative attacks, he looks like a wimp. And if he does, he kind of impeaches himself on what his campaign is about. So I'm really looking forward to seeing what he's going to do in the next couple of days.
Well, we're going to take a break. We're going to come back and talk a little bit about whether there could be a Clinton-Obama ticket, as well as all of the other political mayhem going on, like skin darkening. So stay with us. We're talking with Arlene Fenton, Baratunde Thurston, and Kevin Ross. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Let us continue with our bloggers roundtable. We have got Arlene Fenton from the blog BlackWomenVote.com, Kevin Ross, and Baratunde Thurston. He's a blogger for several sites, including the Huffington Post. And guys, let's just jump right back in here. I want to play you a little bit of Senator Hillary Clinton. She spoke on CBS's early show. She left the door open for a combined ticket with Barack Obama.
Well, that may, be where this is headed. But, of course, we have to decide who's on the top of the ticket. And I think that the people of Ohio very clearly said that it should be me.
Kevin, it's all giggles.
You know what? I got to get back to what Arlene said, though, over at Black Women Vote. I checked out her site. I checked out Baratunde regularly at Jack and Jill. But look, the bottom line is Barack Obama has got, you remember that game, Rock'em Sock'em Robots, and you had the red one and the blue one? He's got to bash her face in. He's got to knock her block off.
But how do you really feel?
He's got to knock her block off. Because in the game of politics, if we were dealing with those robots, that's the objective. You've got to knock the block off. And then afterwards...
I didn't think black men could do that to white men.
Hey. And you know what?
Careful,
now, that's a whole other topic for a whole different discussion. But I know over at Three Brothers and the Sisters, where we blog, we're looking at it from a standpoint of Barack. Ultimately, you are going to pick someone other than Hillary to run as your VP, but Hillary has a vested interest in running for you. But for now, you got to make her say, and make this thing really jump off, because you see how it's had a positive impact on her campaign.
Arlene, that's laying a line in the sand. Do you think, I mean, Barack Obama, when he repeats change and hope and change and hope, can he go nasty? Or is that just not going to suit him?
See, that's the problem, because I think it'll work for black people. But I don't think that certain folks are going to deal with that.
Hey, it works for me, and no, I'm a Republican, so you know.
Well, it goes well beyond black people, too, just to throw that in.
But yeah, ahead. Yeah, I know. But I think that really, I think that the Kumbaya crowd will have major issues with it. I do.
But we all know it's going to be nasty,
though. I do think
he
needs to go on the offensive. I completely agree with that. But I think he's going to need to be very crafty about how he goes about it. Essentially.
Well, let's talk about another shade of photographs and another shade of politics. There is a controversial new ad for Hillary Clinton, and some of the Obama supporters say that it deliberately darkens Barack Obama's skin color. It's, you know, this image from the debate. It's a video image, and he looks a little purplish to me. Arlene, do you think that this is malicious or just, you know, bad lighting? What's going on here?
You know something? I have a problem with both sides of this argument. I am a fairly dark-skinned woman, and, you know, pictures are taken of me, and I look all kinds of different shades. Now, I'm not saying that they're innocent, okay, with what they've done with this picture, but I also have a problem with the extreme exception that's being made with the fact that his skin appears darker, because to me, there's an underlying agreement that darker skin is somehow undesirable. And I have a major issue with colorism, which is assigning virtue or vice according to skin shade.
But how does that work with a biracial brother, though? I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, you know, not to just jump in, but I I'm a brown skin brother. And like I said, mm-hmm. I'm a Republican, and I'm looking at this from a standpoint of, look, I don't care if they darken or lighten this picture. Between YouTube clips and blogs like all of ours, I'm getting most of my information from Brevetunde over at Jack and Jill or what you – I didn't even know that this was an issue, Arlene, until I went over to your site and saw the pictures. And so I think that's where we as black bloggers come into play, because we are now shaping the conversation. Black folks are mm-hmm. and non-black people are coming to our sites and saying, well, I know what CNN said and I know what Farai had on her show, but what does Brevetunde really think? And we're reading it. So I know that Brevetunde was at Costco and was shopping in Dallas and looking at all these folks.
Yo,
so
you're stalking me, bro.
Hey, I'm a former judge. I do my homework.
I know. It's,
you know,
oh
that's
my.
How
yeah,
that's,
you better,
that's
you
how
better
I roll.
Be careful.
That's how I roll. But I think that given what's going on with technology, when this is all over, we're going to look at the role as black bloggers that we have played and really dealing with these issues. It's not like back in the day when OJ's picture was darkened on the cover of Newsweek and we didn't have an outlet. We've got right. the outlet.
Well,
right
let me ask you about that Brevetunde. I mean, back in 94, there was that picture of OJ darkened, and you know, the editors of Time said that it was to make him to reflect the sorrow of the moment or something like that.
But it reflected the sorrow of the state of the media at that time, and I think it reflects yes, the sorrow of Hillary Clinton's campaign. Look, the darkening of the photo is not the single incident. And I think I feel very frustrated when I'm asked to respond to specific moments, because everybody thinks that black folks are being oversensitive. This is the latest in a string of kind of unimaginative appeals to people's darker instincts, pun intended. And I think when you add that up with the drug dealer comments, with the Jesse Jackson comparisons, with the reference to him as a cool hip friend, with the dissing of all of his supporters as somehow delusional, with the constant moving of the line from one primary to the next such that a 20-point lead that collapsed into a 4-point victory is somehow seen as a major comeback.
Preach, brother.
Those are the things that I think are on the minds of our readers, on the minds of a lot of people that are not getting out there. And the narrative that's been shaped doesn't really reflect the reality on the ground. Look, J. Rue the Damager had an album come out in the early 90s called The Wrath of the Math. And I think it's time in many ways for the Clinton people and the Clinton campaign to reflect on that title and just look at what's possible here. There is some merit to the idea that, yes, bloodying him up is good, it toughens him, but at the same time, we've got to move to the general. And I think what I'm hearing here in Dallas a lot is people are nervous that we're getting beyond the threshold of toughening Obama up and into the threshold of just tearing him down.
All right, I have one last question, and it's a speed round question. So there's been this new study by the Center for Media and Public Affairs at George Mason University. They found the networks were harder on Hillary Clinton. And over the weekend, Saturday Night Live even had a little fun with a skit about the debates.
Senator Clinton, who is this man? What's his name? Dmitry Medvedev, Senator Obama, same question.
Dmitry Medvedev.
Correct. Senator Clinton, Nigeria's foreign affairs minister. Can you name him?
I don't know.
Ojo Moduekwe. Senator Obama, same question.
Ojo Moduekwe.
Correct.
And that brings tonight's debate to a close.
All right, the speed round question is, do you think that Obama has gotten a hall pass by some of the media who love him? Kevin?
You're asking a black man, is this black man getting a hall pass to be the president of the United States?
Yeah.
The bottom line is, he is still a black man. He is still running for the most powerful position in the world. I'll just say no, he's not getting a pass. Hillary's just whining. And the bottom line is, she's not as likable. I think that's what it comes down to.
Arlene?
I say yes, but it was a setup. I've seen this many times. I think the press loves to build people up because the spectacular fall is an even bigger story. So I think it's a factor of certain people being very biased, who I probably wouldn't name right now. But I think it's just a dynamic in politics in general.
Oh, Arlene,
which
go ahead,
benefited
name
from.
Him. Name him, Arlene, go ahead.
All right, we don't have time for all that. Baratunde.
Look, I think that there's some room for people's personal kind of opinions to shine through. But more importantly, I think it discounts the bias that, again, sort of assumes that she somehow still has a legitimate shot at this. And that's a deeper bias, the fact that it keeps playing out of 12 straight losses, that she's somehow legitimate. And furthermore, I think we've seen that media bias itself isn't that important. Perception of media bias is what's important. And as a lot of conservative and right-wing folks have done, bullying the media into putting someone like Tucker Carlson on PBS for Fair and Balance, I think what the Clintons are playing on here is further victimhood and victimization. And she's raised that flag many times before in this race. This is just another one. You don't whine to win. No great leader has ever done so by whining. And that's a bit frustrating to watch all this go down.
All right. Well, guys, it has been great talking to you. Take care.
All right.
Thank you.
Take
care.
Later, y'all.
We've been talking with Arlene Fenton from BlackWomenVote.com. She was at the Audio Post Studios in Philadelphia. Self-described vigilante pundit Baratunde Thurston, who blogs at the Huffington Post and Jack and Jill Politics under the pseudonym Jack Turner. He was at KERA in Dallas, Texas. And former Los Angeles Superior Court Judge Kevin Ross, who blogs at Three Brothers and a Sister. He was with me at our NPR West studios. You can find links to their blogs and ours at nprnewsandnotes.org. And the conversation doesn't stop here. Our online series, Speak Your Mind, gives you a chance to sound off on the issues you care about. To find out how, go to our blog, nprnewsandviews.org, and click on Speak Your Mind. Every day we face situations that can push us into the red zone. Bad drivers, out-of-control kids, or a boss who's riding you hard, just to name a few. But do we have to get angry, or can we make choices to keep our feelings in check? Lynn Toler wields the gavel on TV's Divorce Court. She says there are ways to think our way out of the most challenging emotional situations. It's a concept she calls emotional acuity, and she says it can keep you centered under the most trying of circumstances. Now, Judge Toler is going to join us every other week as a regular contributor. We're going to pick her brain on topics that she knows plenty about: family, family law, criminal justice, mental health. Judge Toler's with us now to talk about ways to take control of our emotions and our lives. Good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you, too.
So explain, what exactly is mental acuity?
Emotional acuity is the ability to think your way through how you feel. And it is a response to the immediate response by a practiced process. We spend a lot of time learning these days about math and numbers and figures and English, and we don't take a lot of time to learn how to feel and to feel appropriately, to pick the emotions that we are going to have. And our emotional preparation tends to be a very haphazard thing. And what emotional acuity is the deliberate and purposeful development of emotional skills, which I think often has more to do with how well you do in a circumstance than the information that you have.
Well, why don't you give me an example? I'll give you something in my own life, you know, that I struggle with, which is sometimes I am, you know, I'm a bit on the weak side when it comes to controlling my eating habits, and I'm an emotional eater. What would you say, you know, if someone is going, and that's not a criminal offense, but it's certainly not healthy, if you're someone who keeps walking down the same emotional road over and over again, what do you do about that? What's the emotional acuity that you have to apply there?
first you have to start way before you get upset. You have to start at the store of the grocery, at the door of the grocery. When you go in there, you have a list, and that list will be a list of all of the good things that you need to have in your house. None of the chips, none of the stuff that you love, because you on that day are going to decide you're going to control your emotions, you're going to control how you eat, and you only bring that home. Then you give it voice. I gave mine voice. I went through that myself on the refrigerator, and I put a picture of me when I was thin and me afterwards. What do you really want to do? And actually put that on the refrigerator that I had to see. The combination of those two things, having made a decision at the grocery store door only to bring those things in the house that I need to eat and will not eat outrageously, and then having that reminder on the refrigerator door, that is preparing. That's the process that you go through, so the emotion of the moment can get ahead of you because you're already prepared for it.
Let's talk about things that are much more serious. There are issues like, assault and battery that happen between family members when emotions are out of control. That's a whole magnitude of seriousness, and I'm sure you've seen a lot of it in your work over time. How do you deal with people who really can be violent and criminal when they let their emotions get away from them?
Often I saw that in municipal court, and often I was seeing a lot more intergenerational domestic violence, sons and fathers, sons and mothers, a whole lot of abuse going on. And what I found is I would have families that would repeat, come to my court over and over again. And what I found is that they were in what I called high-volume households. The emotional level is already at a keen pitch every morning. And in order to get heard, in order for you to believe that you're going to be heard, you have to take it up. So it gets ratcheted up all day long. There has to be someone in the house who decides we are going to deal with each other one day when nobody's excited about anything and talk about what's going on. And when I had mothers in there that were like that and parents in there like that, I said, don't address any issue of any significance while you are angry. Walk out and leave. You have moments of calm. That's when you talk about the first thing, which is the emotional atmosphere in the house, because it's usually a high-volume household, and no one ever talks about their emotional atmosphere. What's going on? Why is everybody so crazy? What's happening here? And as you talk about it, you talk those things through. And it's a process. There's no one conversation that's going to resolve everything. But it's a matter of meeting it where you live, and that's in your emotional house.
Just very, very briefly, we're starting a month-long series on mental health. If you either are or know someone who has mental health issues, does that change the equation of how you can deal with these issues?
Absolutely. There are some things that you cannot change by attitude, process, or procedure. You can help the people around the person who has mental illness by process and procedure and learning to deal with their chaotic attitude or what's going on. But you have to know when to holler for help, which means you have to not to be afraid or embarrassed to get assistance, therapy, whatever you need to do, go get it.
Well, Judge, it's great to talk to you. We look forward to having you on again.
Okay, thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
Judge Lynn Toler is the star of the nationally syndicated TV show Divorce Court. She's also the author of My Mother's Rules, A Practical Guide to Becoming an Emotional Genius.